Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Raj Malik, partner at Pixel Perfect Ventures. Raj, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Excited for the conversation today.
Yeah, likewise. So with that, why don't we start with Pixel Perfect? You know, we'd love to know the firm's investment thesis and where you guys are seeking to add value in the market.
So we are a firm that was actually born out of a company. We were previously at a company called Audex Health Solutions that raised a bunch of money and then sold to a company called United Health Group. And we grew and scaled the business inside of United. And in 2019, myself and my partners left. It was at that name, the name of the company was called Rally Health inside United Health Group. And so the CFO, our head of product and technology, and myself and our CTO, we all left to create Pixel Perfect. And so our approach, which is a little bit different out there, was we've been quintessentially operators. We've been operators our entire life. And so we thought, let's flip the script a little bit. And in 2019, when we left, we said, let's try to figure out this investment game. And so we invest our own money. It's ourselves. And we really focus on areas where we've had prior exits. Between my partners and I, we've had 10 exits. Those have ranged from sort of multi-billion dollar exits to even some ones all the way down to potential acq hires as well, too, where we sold just assets. And so we invest generally in digital health, insurtech, anything in the B2B enterprise space. And we've also done some in e-commerce as well, too. So our thesis is really be focusing on areas where we have had prior exits, where we feel like we can add value from an operator perspective, not just being able to provide money as well too.
And are you guys any stage in particular that you find as your the sweet spot?
Yeah, so we we started out and we thought that, hey, look, let's, you know, we might invest in very early pre-seed companies. We've learned our lesson after 6 years of doing this, where now we're really focusing on seed stage. So usually we look at companies about 500K ARR, where they've had some degree of product market fit. They've got their first set of customers and they're starting to really look at scaling up their pipeline and being able to deploy capital at a faster rate.
So you mentioned that you and the partners have operating experience. Would love to, if you can give us some background on what that looked like for you personally, leading up to Rally and United before starting Pixel.
So yeah, so I my background's a little bit non-traditional. I actually started my career as an antitrust litigator. I was previously an assistant attorney general, then turned into an antitrust litigator at a big law firm in Washington, D.C. And from there, I generally sort of realized I don't want to be a big law firm partner. I've been working my tail off, you know, for 5 years straight from 2000 to 2005. And I said, you know, in my heart, I want to switch over to the business side. So in 2005, I switched over to a private equity backed company in the legal department. But luckily, I had a fabulous mentor who was a general counsel of the company and said, Raj, whether you're in the legal department or whether you eventually move over to in an operating role in marketing or operations or product, as long as you're helping create shareholder value, I frankly don't care where you are, even though you came in as a lawyer. So it was great to have Bobby Turnage was my mentor who said, Raj, I'm gonna wherever you want to go, go. And so during the time at that private equity backed company, I was able to move over to the business side, running channels and operations there. And we sold the company a couple times. And then from there, I said, okay, I sort of put the law degree in the rearview mirror and then built my own company, sold that. and then joined the digital health company Audax/Rally. The former CFO at the private equity backed company pulled me into Audax, and then sort of the rest is history from there. So I have this legal background that then converted over to very much of a business and operations background. And then when I was at Rally, I ran corporate development and business development there, and then really had the sort of legal privacy team and integration teams reporting into me. So it was really sort of a cross sort of function that ended up reporting into me. So I got a tremendous amount of experience really managing just a fantastic team that we grew from literally a zero state, because we were, you know, we were pre-revenue when I joined the company. I think we were under 20 employees, and you know, I think by the time we left, we were almost at 3,000 employees inside United that had, you know, a couple hundred thousand. So we really grew and scaled the business, you know, on a pretty quick trajectory from just 2000, you know, 2013, 2014 on through to 2019 when we left.
And what was Rally's focus?
So Rally started as a wellness application. So we launched as a wellness application, selling in through payers to employers, and then we started to bolt on after the acquisition. We started to bolt on. We had a cost transparency tool, a provider search as well too, and then we started to do the individual health record for United as well too. So we did a whole host of businesses on top of buying a handful of businesses during that time. That's the way we were able to scale from, you know, from a zero state to, you know, almost 2 billion in revenue in a few years.
All right. So obviously a tremendous amount of experience. Got to wear a lot of different hats, which ultimately resulted in a tremendous amount of success. Now come full circle to Pixel Perfect. Let's start with evaluating founder teams. Given that you've been an operator, you've been in the trenches, what's a profile that you and the partners hone in on when evaluating potential investments?
So the very first thing that we will look at from there's the team and then there's the product, the team and the founder. There's a degree we sort of laugh and we call it like there's got to be some battle scars on that founder.
Yeah.
And the battle scars have to be that they've gone through and they've persevered through some sort of challenges, no matter what it might be, whatever they, you know, whether their prior experience might have been. And how did they bounce back? How did they actually recover from those challenges? Because I think we all know that, you know, when you're in a startup, when you're an early stage company, you will get kicked in the teeth and you will get kicked in the stomach repeatedly. So your ability to be able to pull yourself up from the mat is just, it's table stakes. You have to be able to do it. So their ability to come into some of these pitches and some of these meetings and be able to actually very clearly and concisely say, this is what I built. This is what I've done to date, to what I'm, you know, brought me to this company. And these are the challenges. This is what I've done. This is successes I've had. These are some of the things that I've gone through. And this is what I've gone, what I've made it to the other side. And then the company that they're building now, that they've surrounded themselves with a top-notch team, a team of folks that are, it's not all business founders, or it's all not just technology founders. It's people that are sort of have a nice cross-functional skill set. And then you get to the product. So the product, we really look at a product that needs to be the goal to get that to be best in class. And it has a pipeline, or it has a trajectory to be best in class and can really disrupt the market, but then also something that has a true competitive moat around it. Because what we do see is a lot of times companies build that they build products, especially early stage companies, and they look around, and this is what I'll tell you, one of the biggest red flags when a company comes to us and says, there's no other competitors in the space. There's always going to be some other competitor, even if it's tangential in the space. So it's really important for them to be able to say, hey, here's our product. This is where we're going. This is what's out there in the market. And this is what truly distinguishes ourselves from those other folks. But then this is also what's going to keep us and have a and create a proprietary moat as we grow, build, scale, and ultimately get to a sale of the company.
And so, okay, a bunch to unpack. If we can come back to founders and we'll hit the product. So totally understand the concept that, look, having grit is extremely valuable when you're working in the early staging ecosystem because it's difficult, a tremendous amount of challenges. It's been an emotional roller coaster. How important is it that they've had a company prior to the existing one, or would you be satisfied if they're just they've had some up and downs in the pre-seed seed phase?
Oh, it doesn't necessarily even have to be up and downs in the pre-seed phase. It could be in their prior career. If they were working at a they were working at another small company, or they were even looking at working at a large company, and there was some learnings that sort of occurred, and they ran it was not, because when you're growing up and when you're sort of building yourself in an early stage in a career, whether you're working at a law firm, whether you're working at a private equity backed company, whether you're working at a large company, you're going to go through challenges, and the ability to go and navigate through those challenges and to grow from those challenges and to be coachable as well too, to get to the other side, that's critical. So it's not necessarily that they've had challenges in, from a pre-seed perspective or an early part. But that also might be something that could be helpful as well too. So I would say that it's something that has happened prior to when they're having the call with us. And generally, what we still want to see is some degree of work, because I'll be honest with you, we generally do not invest in folks that are right out of college, right? They have like we like to see our founders spend some time in quote unquote corporate America, or at some type of consulting firm or some type of job where they're able to learn, frankly, and also get some mentorship. Like I will tell, I'll be honest with you. Some of the times that we look at some companies and we meet some folks, and they haven't spent that time at companies where they've been able to get mentorship and be able to learn on someone else's dime, that sometimes for us can be a little bit of a yellow flag. And I'll also say one other corollary to this is, as we look at founders, especially because we tend to bring a lot of our operating experience when we work with founding teams, we truly, truly want founders that are coachable, highly coachable. And I will tell you, there's a lot of times
That's interesting.
that founders will give lip service. Oh, that person, he seems like that he or she may seem like they are there's somebody that can be coachable. But when you're actually rolling up your sleeves and you're in your session, like we are with a lot of our portfolio companies, where we may not be talking about a customer, a big customer meeting, and we are telling them, this is what we experienced when we were pitching this large payer or this large provider or this health system. And if on the other side of the Zoom call, the other person's like, oh, I've done this before. I know that I know how to do this. I've done enough of these things. That's honestly, that's not a good thing. That we, if our diligence and we've gone and we're meeting with, and we have founders that are like that, that's not good. The good, I can say, reflecting now on our 20 portfolio companies, we don't have generally founders like that. We have founders that when we get on the phone, they say, we are pitching X provider or Y payer or this large company, we need help. And we will literally say, okay, you give us what your talking points are going to be, your sales pitch, and we'll give you our feedback in terms of what, because we've been there before. These are some things that'll work. These are some things that may not work. This is how you may want to transition your pitch to cover a few of these particular areas, but stay away from these items because what that if you focus on those on the other side of the phone or on the other side of the Zoom call or whatever customer, that might create more concern. So let's stay away from those items. So being coachable is so critical from a VC's perspective, I think, as we look at early stage founders.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Especially depending on where that person is on their career trajectory. I mean, if it's still early on, I mean, just by benefit of time, they're not going to have the same experience that someone who's further along has. We'd also love to get your opinion on multiple founders. Any do you see upside, downside, or is it inconsequential?
So it's a great question, because my personal background is when I built a company and sold it, I had multiple founders. And We had business founders, we have technology founders as well too, and I thought that was it was a good experience to have the different subject matter expertise in there. I think it was a very it was a it was it got us to where we needed to be at early parts of the company when I didn't have the technical chops and I was able to rely on the CTO for technical related issues, especially as I said, oh, we can just get this developed, we can get this thing launched. And he looked at me and said, Raj, that's gonna that, you don't realize how much you're about to potentially sign up for this potential customer, and this could be months worth of development. So having multiple founders, I think, can be very beneficial. But I will also tell you, it takes a special set of multiple founders to be able to work together, because inevitably there will be tension along the way, and the tension will come as I've seen it when you get money, when you start to have to interact with your board. There's conversations that sometimes some founders aren't a part of, and then that causes potential ill will. So having the relationship dynamics be set and having the expectations and communication with multiple founders, if you are not just in a highly communicative relationship with your other founders, you inevitably there will be there will distrust will be created, and it probably won't end. It won't end well. Now, on the flip side, the solo founder, which for Audax and Rally, the company we built, we had a solo founder. And I think if you would ask potentially Grant, our CEO, it's probably a lonely process. It was a lonely process to be there by himself, but he did a fabulous job of surrounding himself with some really, really solid talent. So I think the solo founder, I think it's incumbent on that solo founder to be even more driven, because it's one thing when you're getting kicked in the teeth and you have multiple founders, someone's going to lift the other person up, which is great. If you're the only one and you're taking it and you're taking that beating repeatedly, that is that's it's an unenviable task to be in, but you have to have super thick skin, but even more importantly, you have to have the intestinal fortitude to keep saying, go forward, go forward, go forward. But I've also seen the solo founders, when they surround themselves with really solid advisors and a network of people that they can pick up the phone and call, and that's exactly what Grant did. I think it increases your chance of success when you're a solo founder like that.
Makes complete sense. I'm curious, when you're going through the investment due diligence process, do you then, if you see a solo founder, are you specifically asking who else is on the C-suite or who's on their advisory board?
So there's usually a why initially. Why is that? Why are you a solo founder? Just to inquire, because a lot of times we see solo founders, a lot of times they're business founders, and so they have to go, as we know, we invest in technology companies. In order to build a technology, you need to have generally a technology team, and so it's a lot of times it's helpful to have a tech founder. So in the very basic question we'd be asking them is, why don't you have a tech founder? Would you want to go do that? So I think more importantly, we would probably be doing two sorts of questions. One would be, how are you setting up this team? How are you going to set up the team for success so that those subject matter areas get filled and you have strong people that can go and actually execute on that? And then the second corollary to that is absolutely what you said. Who's on the board? Who's their advisors? Who are they getting feedback with from on a consistent basis? And who are their mentors? Because I've also seen there's sometimes a benefit of having the multiple founders, because those multiple founders have you have dual networks, you have dual sets of mentors, you have dual advice, like there's just more. Whereas the individual, it's again, you're sort of at the you're only as good as sort of your own particular network and the people around you. So that's one thing that again, the founders, the solo founders that I've seen, who've been very good at recruiting literally the Rolodex. And I think one of the success points, I'll tell you, Christian, for our run at Audax and Rally was Grant had the most phenomenal set of advisors sort of around him. And I think it was very unique. And at the end of the day, it built a tremendous amount of credibility as we went out to market, as we went out to raise, and as we went out to sell the company, because it was a signal to everybody that, look, all of these folks are taking time to be involved, giving time, giving attention, and in some instances, money to the company and to the founder, that there's got to be something there. And there was something there, which was good. But so I also say, where if you have an advisor set, that advisor set, and we'll see that, like, coming back to your original questions, what is that sort of, do we ask questions around that solo advisor, whether it's a solo founder or multiple founders? We will look on their deck. Okay, who's their list of advisors? Who's their advisory board? Who's on their board? Things like that, because that's a signal to us.
Let's talk product. So heard you loud and clear. Moats of tremendous value, downstream effects, purchasing, pricing power, market stay. What have you seen are characteristics of products that lend themselves to starting down the road of having something that resembles a moat?
So we came from, and this is my partner, Rhett, who's on the West Coast, who was the chief product officer, who helped us take the business, take Rally from 0 to 45 million users in just 4 years. And the moat that we created was an absurdly easy to use product. So it was all around ease of use. So our philosophy, Rhett's in particular, was, I'm going to build a Apple-esque experience in healthcare, which had never been done before. And so I think one of the things that we look at from a proprietary and a sort of creating a moat is actually having, and that's the way our, or that's where our name of our firm comes from, pixel perfect. Having something that is literally pixel perfect and is just ridiculously easy to use. Now, I will say, on one side, that does allow you to create an initial proprietary moat. The issue that we've ran into, and what a lot of companies that build beautiful products see, is you get ripped off. That's exactly what happened. But we were 2, 3 years into, and we were well into probably 20 million users on our platform, and probably half of the Fortune 500 companies using the Rally product, before people started to really rip off and actually start to to make some headway. So I would say the one is ease of use. Two is a highly, highly personalized experience. I think that's the one thing. Being able to use data to be able to drive a highly personalized experience and something that's easy to use and that's habit forming, that's something that, and that could be in the enterprise. It's not necessarily on just, we generally invest in the enterprise space. We don't really do D2C, even though we were a B2B2C company, where we did roll out Rally through employers via payers, and then ultimately went to end users. But if you have, whether it be a doctors, nurses, whether it be actuarialist, whether it be a data scientist, if you build a product that is something that's super easy to use and is intuitive, and on top of that, it's personalized, and the data that you have is really driving the experience, that's a wicked combination right now. And it drives adoption, it drives usage, and it drives a product from being, this is nice to have, I'm not, to an actual absolute must have. My job will be made more difficult if I don't have access to that product.
That makes complete sense. So it dovetails really well into artificial intelligence. Would love to get your perspective on the existing 20 some odd portfolio companies and to the degree that they're incorporating AI into their products, but then also, anything in particular that you're bullish on, as you look to add additional companies to the fund.
So yeah, on the AI side, so there's, I would break it up into sort of almost two buckets. There's using AI in the product as a part of the actual solution that's being offered. That's one where that's out there. The one that in healthcare that is probably, I'd say a year ago, I was talking to doctors and they said, I don't know if I really see sort of AI for privacy purposes. And now, as my brother, who's a doctor, calls it pajama time, and order AI is being used to reduce pajama time. And pajama time is so when my brother, for example, or other physicians, they get home at night and they have to reduce their notes to writing, and put that in the EMR. Now there's these AI tools that basically run in the background and pull all like the back and forth between the provider and the patient. And so that's something that goes into the EMR. It sometimes obviously there's a human element to it, which ends up being able to come in there and correct any issues that might be there before it actually gets made put into a patient record. But that's one area that it's everywhere. There's so much of these sort of AI sort of agents that are out there doing that. So that's one component that certainly has taken off. It's only going to be more adopted. And I think in healthcare, whereas a year, 2 years ago, you would talk to providers and providers were reluctant for privacy purposes, I think they're now starting to lean in even more so. But the other main category I would say is the portfolio companies and the fact that they need to be using it across the cross-functional teams. And what I mean by that is your marketing team should be using AI to be creating the content, to be helping literally reducing the labor hours for you to for them to be on social channels, to be rebuilding their websites. And we had a couple calls maybe a year or so ago with some of our portfolio companies, and we were literally showing them some of the things that we were doing ourselves with Pixel or even in our own time, just creating content that we put on LinkedIn, or my partners that were creating content in their own separate sort of lives. I think if you're not doing this, you guys are you are reducing your own output, your own efficiency, and an ability to get more content out the door. And that's just on the marketing side. Then you go on the technology side. We have a portfolio company that has done a fantastic job of being really true stewards of the capital that we've provided for them, and have been able to make it last. They've gone a couple rounds with where they should have probably raised some money, but instead they keep doubling down. They've hidden cash flow break even, which is fabulous. And I was talking to their CTO a couple weeks ago, and essentially said the AI agents on the technology side and development side are saving him so much time that he doesn't like, he was thinking of having an additional couple headcounts that are going to be added for the summer. He goes, "Raj, we actually probably not going to need that now, because I'm able to get so much development done at such a rapid pace by using the AI in order to help on the back end development, especially on the infrastructure." So I came a year ago, I couldn't even imagine of doing that. So really, there's sort of two parts. There's one, which is a portfolio company using it for themselves to maximize efficiency and create more output for themselves. And then there's the second part, which is actually integrating it into the actual solution.
I think I was reading a stat over the weekend, and for everybody's benefit, we're reporting this in March 2025, but one in five of Y Combinator's most recent class, their entire code base was generated by AI completely. And so, yeah, world's changing, that's for sure. And it, when I'm listening to you, and I think this is kind of intuitive too, you just can't help but wonder, how pace will continue to pick up and the implications for early stage companies that want to remain competitive. If you know now that technology can shorten the curve for your competitors. And so it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're absolutely looking at how your portfolio companies, whether existing or future, are incorporating AI. But then also, what steps can they take And correct me if I'm wrong, but what steps can they take to make sure that they're, considering to think about, hey, how are you going to create this moat, knowing that it can't be completely based on technology?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll tell you as well one thing, which is I think on the VC side and investing, I think we also have gotten to the point where there's a little bit of AI fatigue from the pitch because you just see it. It's in every pitch. It's sort of so it's really then incumbent on us to actually ask, well, okay, how's it being used? Show us how it's being used in the actual. And I'm not talking about the development. That's where I'm switching over on more of the solution, like the fact that AI is being used in some companion in some manner, whether it's helping care delivery or care coordination as well too. There's a whole host, and I'm just talking in the digital health space, but it's really incumbent on investors and frankly everybody out there that's interested in this is, well, how actually are you using the AI components, right? How is it being built in the product? And also, how is it being deployed? And where is AI actually being sort of, where is it being triggered in order to deliver the solution that's out there? Because I think there's the, just like 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I think, and maybe 2019, everything was, it was Bitcoin and cyber, or sorry, Bitcoin and blockchain that was in every deck in the late 2010s. Now it's sometimes there'll be slides you'll go through and you never even think that this company would be sort of and have any AI related to it, and then you see it thrown in that random slide 12 on there about why you should invest. As, hey, we're using AI for some X, Y, and Z. And like, okay, are you really using AI, and how's it actually a differentiator? And so it puts a burden on us to say, okay, just actually drill down. And so I will tell you one thing we are also manic about when we meet with companies is, and that's credit to Rhett, my partner, is we're like, okay, some VCs will just say, okay, hey, look, they'll invest based upon sometimes the deck. And we want a hardcore product demo. We will also tell the folks, give us test accounts. We want to get in. We actually want to start using the product. And I would suggest that to other folks that are out there, if they're not already doing that, do that. Have the founders run. And a lot of times the founders, this is something that's near and dear to them. They're spending day and night. They're up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning creating creating this technology. Ask, she or he to say, go give me the actual demo to show me it. And then you can also, when it becomes that much realer, when it's more real, when it's on the screen, and you can see this is how a user is going to go through the user flow, or this is how you're actually deploying the technology and be able to go back and forth. And then lastly, when you say, hey, give me a test account, you give me a test account, I'm going to go play with it, I'm going to tickle the keys and actually get in and check it out. That's fun, because then you see, gosh. And then from our perspective, coming back, when something is really easy to use, you see you can see how it can end up becoming something that folks get addicted to. From a worker's perspective, that's something we say, okay, that's something we want to back, we want to spend time, and we also want to help roll up our sleeves and coach, mentor, and guide the founding team as a part of Pixel.
I love it. In the spirit of being objective, any metrics either pre or post investment that the firm finds itself regularly honing in on?
So I will tell you the most important thing for us, especially since we have the 500K, minimum, is we want to see growth. We absolutely want to see. So it's sort of it's not rocket science, but we want to see two things now, which might be a little bit different than maybe 4 or 5 years ago. We want to see that sort of the quarter over quarter growth, but we also want to see a path to cash flow break even. That's something that I will tell you 4 or 5 years ago, especially like right after COVID, folks were throwing money, and that's why there was a lot of valuations that were sort of ridiculous. And then we had a few portfolio companies, and we sort of learned this as well too, that oh, you have to be focused for every dollar going out. What's the milestones? What are you actually going to get out of this this money that's going out? I think there's sometimes there's a tendency with early stage companies. You've raised a couple $1 million, just fix issues with money. Throw money at this product issue, this sales issue. And I think what we really focus our portfolio companies on is you have to be stewards of capital, and you have to make sure that every dollar that you're putting out, how's it tied to your macro level milestones for your yearly goals, and how those ladder down, and making sure that the dollars are actually going towards that. And then having the check-in. So you asked about sort of metrics. We will say, okay, here's your projections. This is what your numbers are. But let's be manic about making sure we be checking in that we're checking in on a pretty regular basis to see where are you at, and where things are falling down. Okay, what are some decisions that need to be made? Do we need to cut in certain places? Do we need to double down in other areas? And there's also times when we may not have all the answers, and we say, hey, look, you are having a challenge right now with your data science team. From our network, we have ex data scientists previously from LinkedIn, from Twitter, from other folks. We will pull those people in. You will talk to them. We'll be on the phone. We'll help you through. Okay, let's whatever data lake you're trying to pull together, we can sit there and help you get it in a more efficient way so that it's more usable to be able to hit your goals. That's really critical for us as well, too.
Raj, it's been a great podcast. One of the questions I love to close with is that if you had an opportunity to go back and speak with your younger self, what would you share?
That's a fabulous question. It really is. I would tell my younger self, and I tell my 15-year-old daughter this all the time: take more risks, fail more often. Don't be scared of failing. There's too many times when, and I will say, fundamentally, I am here, and I'm a better investor, better operator, frankly, better lawyer, better person because of the failures that I had and what I learned from them. And I think it's so critical that it's when you go through those hard times, being able to get onto the other side and be able to say, gosh, I got through that. That made me stronger. And I'll give one example from the law firm. I remember we had a big filing due, and it was in a case we were litigating against the FTC, and I was responsible for the filing. And I kept telling the partner, it's this, we have 5 days to file this. We actually had 3 days. On day five, we went and filed it. The court dinged it and rejected it. And he came into my office and said, Raj, you said 5 days. I trusted you. It was 3 days. And I looked at him and I said, I literally just had to own it. And that's when I said, you know what? When you make a mistake, you just look at it, you own it, and say, you know what? It was Chris at that time, who was the partner. I said, Chris, I screwed up. I won't let it ever happen again. That's unacceptable. So those types of things, like looking like I will double, triple, quadruple check those types of things now, based upon that one experience. And I tell you, it's those are things that, while it was a mistake, it wasn't necessarily based on a risk that I took. I look back and I said, gosh, it actually made me better, because now I'm even more diligent on those types of things. And more importantly, it made me even more detail oriented.
You know, I've had my experience echoes your perspective. I think we're really fortunate to live in a culture where we encourage risk taking. And you're right. I mean, things aren't always going to work out. But you know, I think the meme I see normally attributes this to Nelson Mandela, whether he said it or not, but it's something along the lines of, you know, win or learn, I never lose. And I 100% agree. You know, to think that you're only going to do something because know you're going to succeed. I can only think of two certainties: death and taxes.
Well, that's the funny thing. I will tell you, at 51 years of age, I have to look at myself in the mirror at times and say, am I taking enough risks? And I will tell you, like I did my 2024, this is interesting. I did my 2024 year-end review in 2025, and I thought, I looked at sort of the accomplishments of 2024, and I looked at 2025 and what was ahead, and I said, I need to actually take more risks. So that's as I'm saying, it's in some ways this podcast has allowed me to almost speak. Not only I would, if that's something I would say to my 18 or 20 year old self, I would actually need to say it and reflect it back to myself to say, hey, where are areas that I can take more risk? And if I fail, fine. I have plenty of years ahead of me, hopefully, that I can learn from it, which is so critical. And I think that we, as a society, there's a time, I think there's a degree of stasis as we get older, where we're not putting ourselves in a position to take those risks. I think we have to be reflective upon ourselves to say, no, now's the time. Take the risk, go do it. Because and also finding those risks sometimes, Christian, I'll be honest. Sometimes you have to go seek those risks out to say, yeah, I'm going to take that meeting, or I'm going to push for that, or I'm going to send that random email, or I'm going to go walk up to that person at that party, even though I don't think maybe I don't belong. I'm going to go walk up and say something to them. You never know what's going to happen.
That's right. I love it. You reminded me of a perspective I recently heard from another great investor, is Peter Thiel. Was commenting on Elon, Peter said something to the effect of, when Elon started SpaceX and Tesla at the same time, we thought he was crazy. And obviously, today everyone's aware of the success he's had with both companies. And Peter commented something along, what along the lines you just said, is like, maybe we just need to reassess how we think about risk, because obviously Elon knows something that we don't. So I think your insights are spot on. Raj, it's been a great podcast. If there's anyone out there who's listening to this and they'd love to get a hold of you to connect, how can they find you?
Best way is probably LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out over LinkedIn. I am also on Twitter, somewhat of a nascent account. You can hit me up there or reach out also over the Pixel website. There's a contact form. You can reach out to us as well too that way. So all three ways.
Fantastic. Raj Malik, partner, Pixel Perfect Ventures. Raj, thank you so much. Appreciate your time and sharing your insights with us.
Christian, thank you so much for having me. This is a blast.
My pleasure. And this is another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of Finchat Management. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.